This is going out to the whole wide west side. Know what I'm saying? Yeah. Break it down for me. Steady mobbing, rock, rock on. I was just a young boy living in the hub city. Eastside Compton. Back in the days when Ice Cube and Easy had every talking about boy you can't.
This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9 on the west side at UBC.
Too short, bumped in every super boat and told us all how to ride for the west coast. My music and let me where you at, throw your gloves in the air and wave them like you just don't care. From LA to the Bay, what you say? All day, every day, any damn day. Take a look around. We got the whole world locked down. Going on and on and don't stop. We won't stop.
Hello, welcome. This is Marco on the west side at UBC, and I was lost here. I couldn't learn how to operate the new stuff, so anyway, here I am, and we're going to do some astronomy today. So last week we talked about the Voyager missions, and space nuts like me will know the Voyager missions. They launched in towards the late 1977, two spacecraft that were taking advantage of a planetary alignment of the outer gas giants. So they could see them because they were in a line or in a row closer together than they'd be in a long time. And they got gravity assist. So for example, when they visited Jupiter, when they left Jupiter, they would fly close to Jupiter, get a gravity assist, be shot out at a high speed, and then carry on to the next planet. So Voyager 2 did a few more years of exploration. It went to Uranus and Neptune. And Voyager 1, while Voyager 2 was doing that, flew out to the outer solar system. So we reviewed about the data they got from some of their instruments they have left. Some of them have been shut down totally. Remember, they're flying on fumes now, or relatively, compared to how much fuel they had before. And a lot of their systems have been shut down. So a few of them, a magnet system and another, I guess, gamma ray system or something like that, would test what was the difference between when the spacecraft was in the solar system and once they crossed the heliosphere or the boundary of the solar system to interstellar space. So we did that last week. I think we did space butterfly and a few other things. So today, what are we going to do? There was nothing on the news, nothing that I saw. The sky wasn't clear that night. So when I looked out, all I saw was clouds. So there's not much to talk about in terms of what I saw in the sky. So what am I going to talk about? Well, one thing that I've always been interested in is spin-off technology. When NASA goes into outer space, it invents all these new technologies. And I think sometimes we all know war is terrible, but some technology is developed or perfected during wartime, and then it's used in our public use. And airplanes was one of those things. So computer systems, I think they're developed or perfected because astronauts or the military has to do certain things. So they developed the technology to do that. And then there's a spinoff. So let's see what spinoffs there are from space. And this is an article on, you know it, www.nasa.gov, dated April 3rd, 2019. And it's under the heading of Space Tech. And the name of the article is New Spinoff Publication Highlights NASA Technology Everywhere. So let's look at what NASA technology is being used for. So again, this is April 3rd, 2019 on NASA.gov. And New Spinoff Publication Highlights NASA Technology Everywhere. Let's see what they did. So from precision GPS to batteries, for one of the world's first commercial all-electric airplanes, NASA technology turns up in nearly every corner of modern life. The latest edition of NASA's spin-off publication features dozens of commercial technologies that were developed or improved by the agency's space program and benefit people everywhere. So let's see what these people say, says Jim Reuter, an acting associate administrator of the NASA's Space Technology Mission Directorate, and quote, NASA works hard not only to develop technology that pushes the boundaries of aeronautics and space exploration, but also to put those innovations into the hand of businesses and entrepreneurs who can turn them into solutions for challenges we all face here on Earth. That's a nice, big, long sentence. So basically what it says is NASA makes technology, and then we use that technology for solutions on Earth. He said it much longer, in about 23 sentences. I said it in 10 words. These are sometimes predictable, like the many NASA technologies now adapted by the burgeoning commercial space industry, but more often they appear in places that may seem unrelated, like hospitals, farms, factories, and family rooms, end quote. And in kitchens, too, because we know NASA developed, I believe it was NASA that developed Teflon, which is used for cooking. So let's see. In this issue of Spinoff, the agency shares new stories of how, one, the world has come to rely on GPS signal correction software created by NASA, which enables precision agriculture, airplane navigation, smartphone, offshore oil drilling, earth science, and much more. Number two, NASA's work to push the envelope of flight resulted in advanced battery packs that power one of the first commercial all-electric planes. Number three, a lightweight, high-pressure tank NASA invented to hold rocket fuel now stores life-saving oxygen to keep pilots, firefighters, and intensive care patients breathing, not to mention gases that power city buses and even paintball guns. Interesting. So those are just three. Let's see what the article says next. The publication provides nearly 50 examples of how NASA benefits various industries and people around the world. For example, fitness enthusiasts may be surprised to learn about NASA's contribution to the Bowflex Revolution Resistance Exercise Home Gym. Interesting. Other highlights include a crucial component of pacemakers that have helped save lives around the world, as well as reactors that use electricity breathing bacteria to clean wastewater and generate power at wineries and breweries. So says Daniel Lochney, an executive of NASA's Technology Transfer Program, and quote, the variety and complexity of NASA's missions drive innovations in virtually every field of technology. The result is that there's not an industry or business out there that can't make use of our groundbreaking work. The publication also includes a spin-off of tomorrow's section. So let me read the title of this again so people can go to it. If anybody out there, if any Martian, if not any Earthling, but if a Martian's listening, you can listen. And the article is New Spin-off Publication Highlights NASA Technology Everywhere. It's dated April 3rd, 2019. It says release 19-019. I don't know what that means. It's under Space Tech on www.nasa.gov. The publication also includes a spin-offs of tomorrow section. Spin-offs of tomorrow. What can we use in the future? That showcases 20 new NASA technologies available for license. One innovation on the list uses new materials to literally reinvent the wheel. The super elastic tires were inspired by the Apollo era and developed for future exploration of the moon and Mars. The technology could find another purpose on Earth. Spinoff is part of the agency's technology transfer program within the Space Technology Mission Directorate. The program is charged with finding the widest possible applications for NASA technology through partnerships and licensing agreements with industry, ensuring that NASA's investments in its missions and research find additional applications that benefit the nation and the world. Print and digital versions of the latest issue of Spinoff are available at https://spinoff.nasa.gov/big S. So Spinoff, big S, 2019/index.html. Okay, so go to the article, dated April 3rd, new Spinoff publication, highlights NASA technology everywhere, and there's a link here. Print and digital versions of the latest issue of Spinoff are available at https://spinoff.nasa.gov/big S for Spinoff 2019/index.html. And I just opened it. Oh, and now it says read Spinoff, and there, click here to read an online HTML. And then there's more. Let's take one of these. Image analysis software sees cancers in 3D. Okay, so let's read this one. I went to that web link I gave you, and then I pressed the HTML version, and then it says, image analysis software sees cancers in 3D. This is for health and medicine, and it's under NASA technology. Okay, even NASA can be surprised. NASA works hard to search out surprising discoveries, of course, but it works equally hard to avoid unpleasant ones related to the safety of its astronauts. In the interest of the latter, NASA has identified approximately 30 risks to humans in space, from increased radiation to decompression sickness to interpersonal conflict between crew members. All these risks are being studied carefully, explains Craig Kundrat, Division Director for Space Life and Physical Sciences Research and Applications, and any gaps in knowledge are being identified. But even with this detailed roadmap of risks, he notes there are still unknowns. So says Craig Kundrat, and quote, when we went from 2-week shuttle missions to 6-month space station missions, that was a 12-fold increase in duration. All of a sudden, we started seeing these vision problems, he recalls. That caught us by surprise, end quote. Although NASA is still working fully to understand the details of these vision changes and just how much a risk they pose, researchers believe they are related to changes in blood flow and microgravity, which is something that's been studied for many years. One of these studies dates back to the shuttle days. Ron Madura of the Cleveland Clinic's Lerner Research Institute studied the hypothesis that vascular remodeling precedes and impacts muscle and bone loss. His project started with a ground-based model, studying the hind leg of rats kept elevated to mimic the decreased blood flow seen in microgravity. But after he began, he was presented with an opportunity to incorporate his study tissue samples from mice that had flown on the shuttle in 2011, which he could then compare with his ground-based sample. So says Ron Madura, and quote, the concept from our end was to look at gene expression changes in endothelial cells, which line blood vessels, to see if they are altered in space flight compared to ground control system, end quote. Another crucial part of getting useful data was being able to count the number of blood cells in the tissue sample and making careful measurements of the thickness and shape of the vessels. Okay, I'm going to pause here for a sec because I thought this article was image analysis software that sees cancer in 3D. So I hope it leads into that, because what we're talking about now is decreased blood flow and microgravity. Okay. Any manual counting of tissues, even by highly trained technicians, would have been subjective and led to necessary variability. It takes a long time, even for someone's experience, to do the full set of analysis we want for each tissue section. Instead, Madura decided to turn to computer analysis to find the stained blood vessels, and knowing the spatial size of the pixel and images, calculate their number, size, thickness, and other attributes. To get the analysis, he turned to a software program created by ImageQ, which was originally spun out from the Cleveland Clinic and has since been acquired by Philadelphia-based ETR. Image's IQ software library was developed to analyze 2 and 3D images for research, but as is typical for bleeding-edge research, the specific type of analysis was looking for Maduro was looking for required some innovation. We found that trying to force fit endpoints and metrics into previous existing software didn't work. Instead, the company custom developed an algorithm, and the algorithm looks at every single pixel and looks around to see whether it's just noise or belongs to a larger structure that belongs to the analysis. In this way, the program is able to identify structured edges in a way that might not be visible to human eye, and it can make extremely accurate measurements across the whole image. All of the work was specific to its project. Van Lasangi says it has proved useful for many other projects. And quote, we talk about it like a spice rack. Every specific project requires a different mix of spices and ingredients. Once they create an algorithm, however, it goes on the shelf and can be used later. Now, here comes the benefits. Maduro's study was successful. It showed there are genetic changes in the lower leg vascular system during spaceflight, and these precede the bone and muscle loss that have been observed, though he's quick to caution that the work is very much ongoing. Over at ETR, I hope we're getting to the cancer part, but Vasanji notes the advanced imaging software has also powered quite a few important scientific results unrelated to spaceflight, for example, in the clinical study of pulmonary embolosis. Another potentially life-saving application to help study cancer and one day helpfully treat it, specifically using the filters and algorithms created for Maduro, researchers can identify the three-dimensional shape of the tumor within an image series. Right now, in clinical practice, the standard is to do a 2D view and a CT scan. But if the tumor is in a regular shape, that two-dimensional slice will miss a great deal of information that would be extremely useful. For example, for a surgeon learning to excise it. A key benefit of ETR's advanced imaging software is part of what drew Maduro initially, that when humans do the counting, the results are not consistent. You get two readers looking at the same scan. We've seen in some cases 70% variability. That variability doesn't happen when the computer does the analysis because the computer applies the same rules in every way. So I'm not sure how, but it seems that this can study the shape of a cancer and actually see it better. So when the surgeon goes to take it out, the surgeon knows from the scan exactly how much is taken out or what to take out, because as it says here, when humans did the counting of the muscles in space, there was a great variability up to 70%. So I guess that this imaging software helps to image tumors better so they get a more accurate picture of the tumor. And to my listeners, I'm sorry it took so long. I thought they were going to give me something quick, but it was quite long. But actually, that is just one way that they're using technology from space. They used an algorithm to count muscle tissues on rats, and they found that this could get better images of cancer tumors. And from that, they could get a nice picture of the cancer tumor before the surgeon goes in. Okay, so thanks for listening. That was quite long. I didn't expect it to be that long. But anyway, that's how things go in the world of astronomy. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go for a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more astronomy. So we just talked about technology spin-offs. So remember, this was the article, April 3rd, 2019. I apologize. I didn't expect that second section to go so quickly or so long. I was reading one of the spin-offs. I thought it would be a quick thing, but it took a while. So basically what it was, the spin-off was they were counting the rat's tissue in space of the muscles, I believe the leg muscles, and they were doing counts how much it deteriorated, but in space it was hard to count for humans. So they developed an algorithm to to count it. And from this, they spun it off. And in cancer research, they got better images of the cancer tumors before the surgeon went in. So the surgeon knew what he was going to take out of the person's body. So NASA spinoffs, this is in an article called New Spinoff Publication Highlights NASA Technology Everywhere, released April 3rd. So thank you for listening. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer, back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Loading Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
AstroTalk with Stefan Don on CITR 101.9. Welcome back. This is Marco, and you have been listening to Stefan Don with Abracadabra. Now let's talk about something that was a related article was on the news, the TV news the other day. They were saying that BC is warming up twice as fast as the rest of the world in terms of global warming. So that's a caution. Global warming is a threat to our survival now and in the future. So I'm not sure how they measured it, but basically they said, we're not doing our part in Canada. So in that light, I'm going to talk about glaciers. So I guess, I think Vancouver Island had a certain number of glaciers before. Now it might be reduced to 5. And inland BC, it had a certain amount of glaciers, and that has been reduced now. So let's talk about now Alaska, big place, really big. And it's glaciers, and of course it's way up north, and there's danger in Alaska. So this is an article. It's called Under the Heading of Ice. Okay. It's dated March 29, 2019, and the article is on www.nasa.gov, A Decade of Exploring Alaska's Mountain Glaciers. Let's read on what NASA's doing to help explore about NASA's mountain glacier. So I know there was certain things that NASA was doing. It could get a bird's eye view of things, a better overall view and in terms of data, collecting data, than people on the ground. So going to read the article. A decade of exploring Alaska's mountain glaciers, dated March 29, 2019. In Alaska, 5% of the land is covered by glaciers that are losing a lot of ice and contributing to sea level rise. To monitor these changes, a small team of NASA-funded research has been flying scientific instruments on a bright red single-engine plane since spring 2018. So it shows the plane, and it says flying low over some of the most dramatic landscapes on the planet. A cadre of scientists and pilots have been measuring changes in Alaska's glacier as part of NASA's Operation IceBridge for almost a decade. The team has seen significant change in ice extent and thickness over time. Okay, here goes the article. There's a picture of a plane flying over. In almost a decade of operations, the Operation IceBridge Alaska team has more than doubled the number of mountain glaciers surveyed in the state known as the Last Frontier. Data from the mission has put numbers to the loss of Alaska glaciers from 1994 to 1913, so that's about two decades. 75 gigatons of ice every year. Measurements from the campaign have helped scientists determine that most of the mass loss in Alaska's icy fields is due to surface melt rather than the warming ocean waters. NASA's Operation IceBridge Airborne Science Campaign have been measuring Earth's changing glaciers and ice sheets since 2009. IceBridge was conceived to avoid a gap in measurements of ice height between two satellite missions, ICESat-2 and ICESat. While scientists at NASA's Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, Goddard, managed two larger yearly field campaigns in the Arctic and Antarctic, monitoring Alaskan glaciers fell on a smaller team based at the University of Fairbanks, Alaska. NASA wanted to find existing systems that were capable of doing these measurements from airplane and getting them going right away. University of Fairbanks had an ongoing altimetry program since 1991 and a system that was flight ready. Challenging mountain flight. So what is a challenging mountain flight? Equal in size to six Yellowstone National Parks, Wrangell State Elias National Park and Preserve in Southeast Alaska. It's the largest national park in the U.S. The remote sites offer breathtaking views of extensive boreal forests, braided glacier fields, and towering mountains, and also provides optimal access to many of the main ice fields in the region. So says Larson, and quote, both melt and ice flow both occurred at much faster rate than they do in Greenland and Antarctica. The difference between a glacier in May and that same glacier in August is huge, end quote. So they're studying the size of the glaciers and they're seeing the glaciers are going really melting a lot faster than they thought. Okay, so I'm just going to conclude this article because basically what I already said in Greenland and Antarctic, there has a lot of ice has been lost. So what they says is, among the final targets was Malaspina Glacier. Malaspina is North America's largest Piedmont Glacier, a confluence of large valley glaciers that meet to form an almost stagnant lobe crisscrossed by psychedelic patterns of settlement. The glacier, so huge it's visible from space, is thinning at the statewide average of 2.3 feet per year, but its massive ablation zone makes it vulnerable to future warming. So says Larson, and quote, Malaspina has the potential of being one of the bigger geographical evolutions in Alaska of our time. Certainly my son could be able to witness some big geography changes there as it could open up a large lake or bay, end quote, with dozens of glaciers surveyed in southeast Alaska. Larson's team was finally grounded for several days because of a storm, but they still managed to complete 50 hours of science flights. The following month in September, ICESat launched and the gap in measurements of ice height in the polar regions was fully bridged. Larson's expecting new spacecraft to perform well with mountain glaciers. What is great about ICESat 2 is that it has multiple laser beams, so each pass of the satellite, in effect, covers multiple ground tracks, and this will help with smaller targets such as Alaskan ice glaciers. For more on NASA's Operation IceBridge, visit https://www.nasa.gov/mission/_pages/icebridge/index.html Okay, so what I have to apologize for, I couldn't read that because what happened is I have a bad thumb that might need an operation and I can't use it. So I couldn't toggle around. The page is so big, I had to toggle back and forth. So I apologize. I didn't do a good job on reading that. But in a way, that just basically summarized that glaciers are melting and there's lots of ice loss in our world. And this is all to do with global warming. So I'm sorry I couldn't read that very well, but the way the page was, I just couldn't toggle around it. So I apologize. So why don't I do this now? I'm going to go for a break and I'm going to get all back into form. And when we come back, we will talk more astronomy. And this time I'm going to talk about way out in outer space, not on Earth. So this is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. Fum, tell the driver, here you come. You're coming to listen to Astro Talk with Frankie Smith and the Double Dutch Bus on CITR 101.9 at UBC. Sizzle, gizzit, gizzay, bizzit. I used to dance to this in 1981 in downtown Vancouver. But now you're listening to this at CITR 101.9 down in 2018.
Oh my gosh, Lauren, I have always wanted to be on the radio.
Christy, you know you can do that at CITR and Discorder, right?
What?
Yeah, you can get a show or help with live broadcasts and interview people at shows around the city and make ads and PSAs that play during the shows.
Wow!
Yeah, just email volunteer at CITR.ca and they can help you get started or just come into the station whenever.
I will! Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you!
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Welcome back. This is Marco. Hello. Give blood. Good for you. Okay, if you give blood, good for you. Now, I'm going to talk about another mission called Clipper. So one of the great things about this job, did I just call it a job? Okay, this is my job. On Thursday, it's my job for 1 hour. And I talked to brilliant people. One of them was Trina Ray. She was on the Cassini mission. And that ended last year, a couple of years ago. And she said it was sad because people are cleaning out their desks. And all these people that you basically live with for 10 or 20 years. And then you go to their parties and you meet their family. So you become like family. And bang, it all ends. So it's not just the mission that's ending. It's all these relationships that you've made because people go their own way. Well, Trina Ray, I believe, she's going to stay there at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Hi, Trina. And she is going to work on the new Clipper mission. So the Clipper mission is going to go to, I guess, it's the biggest moon in the solar system. It's Europa. And they're going to go study Europa. And this is different than the Cassini mission. So the Cassini mission was out there for, I believe, 13 years. It was extended a few times. I think its original timeline was like 4 years. But then it got a bunch of extensions. And then they studied a lot of the moons. They studied the rings. They studied Saturn. And then they crash-landed into Saturn. I don't know how you can crash-land into a gaseous atmosphere, but they did. I guess it just burned up. Or maybe the pressure squeezed the spacecraft to a little pulp. So she got transferred, or she was already hired for the Clipper mission. So Europa Clipper is going to go, I think, within the near future. It's going to fly over to Jupiter, and it's going to study their moon Europa. So I should know this. I guess I did before. I forgot it. There's Europa, Ganymede, Io, and Callisto. I believe those are the four inner moons of Saturn. I believe they're the bigger moons. And Europa, I believe, is the biggest moon in the solar system. So Clipper's going to go to Europa and study it. So this is an article about Clipper. It's titled, Europa Clipper High Gain Antenna Undergoes Testing at Langley. It's dated April 1st, 2019. This is on www.nasa.gov. And it shows a full-scale prototype of the Europa Clipper's high-gain antenna, and it's undergoing testing in the experimental test range at NASA's Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. The Europa Clipper is expected to launch on a mission to conduct detailed reconnaissance of Jupiter's moon Europa in the 2020s. So I don't think it's going to ever land on Europa, but it will, let me think. It will fly around Europa. And I'm going to think, compare it to Cassini that went around Saturn. I guess there's that little, what's it called? A little probe or a little R2-D2 probe could eject from Cassini and could, I think it floated through the atmosphere of Titan, and it could have landed on Titan. So that's a difference. I don't know if Europa Clipper has one like that. So little R2-D2 did its job there. So here we are. We're going to talk about Europa Clipper. The article is April 1st, 2019 on www.nasa.gov. And it says Europa Clipper high-gain antenna undergoes testing at Langley. It probably goes without saying, but this isn't your everyday satellite dish. In fact, it's not a satellite dish at all. It's a high-gain antenna, abbreviated HGA, and a future version of it will send and receive signals to and from Earth from a looping orbit around Jupiter. The antenna will take that long journey aboard Europa Clipper, a spacecraft that will conduct detailed reconnaissance of Jupiter's moon Europa to see whether the icy orb could harbor conditions suitable for life. Scientists believe there's a massive salty ocean beneath Europa's icy surface. The antenna will beam back high-resolution images and scientific data from Europa Clipper's cameras and science instruments. On Saturn, there's that icy moon. I forget what it's called. It's right on the tip of my tongue. But either that icy moon or another moon in Saturn, they were seeing how much it rocks. And from that, they could tell, or they could maybe even calculate how large they believe the undersurface ocean was on that moon. So they do all kinds of cool experiments. And from their experiments, which I could never fathom myself, they are able to determine how much because of the way it rocks, how much undersurface water there was. So that's what NASA does. Here, I remember the moon. It was Enceladus. So Enceladus is a moon. Sorry, I usually know it, just right away say it, but it was on the tip of my tongue. So Enceladus has an icy surface, and they believe there's an underwater ocean there, or undersurface ocean, and there's geysers spouting out. I believe it's in the South Pole, and they are testing a number of moons to see if that happens, and the one they're going to test now with a spacecraft going to it is Europa. So they're going to test, they do all these wonderful experiments to test how big the ocean is. I don't believe they can get a real accurate measurement. They have to do it through some kind of calculation, and we'll see how they do that or what kind of science they do. Okay, so the antenna that they will take along in that long journey aboard Europa Clipper. So we're talking about an antenna that they're testing at Langley. And sorry, what's the antenna's name? HGA, High Gain Antenna, will conduct detailed reconnaissance of Jupiter's moon, Europa, to see whether the icy orb could harbor conditions suitable for life. Scientists believe there's a massive salty ocean beneath Europa's icy surface. The antenna will beam back high-resolution pics. The full-scale prototype antenna, which at 10 feet tall is the same height as a standard basketball hoop, is in the experimental test range, ETR at NASA's Langley Research Center in Virginia. Researchers from JPL in Pasadena, the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, and Langley are testing the prototype in the ETR in order to assess its performance and demonstrate the high pointing accuracies required for the Europa Clipper mission. The ETR is an indoor electromagnetic test facility that allows researchers to characterize transmitters, receivers, antenna, and other electromagnetic components and subsystems in a scientifically controlled environment. So says Thomas Magner, an assistant project manager for Europa Clipper, and quote, "Several years ago, we scoured the country to find a facility that was capable of making the difficult measurements that would be required on the HGA and found that the ETR clearly was it. The measurements that will be performed in the ETR will demonstrate that the Europa Clipper mission can get a large volume of scientific data back to Earth and ultimately determine the habitability of Europa," end quote. I always go on these sides, and I'm going to go on another one now. I think I remember when they were testing a spacecraft, they put it inside this big facility in Houston, and they had to create a vacuum. So it took quite a while to put it in there, and then it took maybe a week or two to clear the air out to make the vacuum. Then they do the tests. Then they pressurize the chamber again. Then they take it out. Sometimes these tests are very complicated, and they take months. So these are not easy tests. What I have seen are sometimes very difficult tests because of what you have to do to set up the test. Okay, tests on this prototype antenna are scheduled to wrap up soon. However, researchers plan to return to the experimental test range, ETR, in 2020 to conduct acceptance tests on Europa's high-gain antenna flight article. Europa Clipper plans to launch in the 2020s. With travel time to Jupiter of 3 to 7 years, depending on the launch vehicle and which planetary alignments can be utilized. So imagine now I am looking at this and I'm saying, okay, we have the Europa spacecraft, and then it talks about a launch window, and it could take 3 to 7 years, depending on the launch vehicle. So there's so many things you have to take into account. And not just this, now they're testing the antenna. Which other things do they have to test on the spacecraft? It would behoove me to look into this. I'll try to do that for next week. I'll look into the spacecraft, and I recall that the OSIRIS-REx mission that is now orbiting the asteroid Bennu, it will orbit for a little while more, maybe 9-10 more months, then it will touch down, and it will get samples from the surface. I looked at that spacecraft itself and all the systems on it. Wow, there are a lot of very complicated systems. And I guess sometimes I'm one of the first people to complain when something like the next generation James Webb Space Telescope has been delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. I guess that they have to do their job. They have to do it right. And there are so many things to test. So they are now testing the Europa Clipper antenna. So I can't imagine the multitude of tests. And something like the James Webb Space Telescope, it has to be, I don't want to say something that's incorrect, but I believe part of the space telescope, or part of certain space telescopes, they have to operate at a very cold temperature, close to absolute zero, because they don't want any signals from the spacecraft to be interpreted as data coming from a star or a nebula or something or a planet, when actually what it is, it's some kind of heat coming from the spacecraft itself. So the antenna has to be shielded so the data coming in will not be misinterpreted, so they won't pick up data, heat signals from the spacecraft. So there's so many things to test on this. And when I looked at Europa Clipper, I never realized before this that, okay, yeah, they have a high-gain antenna. And what other things do they have? They probably have a number of systems, magnetic or whatever they are, to test while they're up there on Europa. So there's lots of things to test, and I complain, so I'll keep complaining, though, because I'm so excited when that James Webb, I will be so excited when the James Webb telescope finally gets there, but it's been delayed so many times. But reading this article, I can see there's so many things to take into account, so many systems to test, so many variables that I could never even conceive. So anyway, let's read a quote now. So you don't have to listen to me talk. You can actually listen to an astronomer talk. So now this is a quote from Charmaine Frank, head of Langley's Electromagnetics, Electromagnetics and Sensors Branch. And quote, our branch members are excited that these key test activities achieved through specialized facility modifications and enhancements made to the ETR these past few years are significantly contributing towards the ultimate success of the Europa Clipper. ETR has become a new NASA capability in space-based communication systems research with its extended frequency range from X-band to Ka-band. I've heard those bands before, end quote. I've heard those bands, now I forget what it means. Okay, see, there's a lot of things to take into account. JPL manages the Europa Clipper mission for NASA's Science Mission Directorate. The multiple flyby concept was developed in partnership with the Applied Physics Laboratory. So let's take a look at Europa Clipper. I'm just going to click this, and if it doesn't take too long, we can go to Europa Clipper. So here's an article, the one I just read. Europa Clipper, high-gain antenna, undergoes testing at Langley. And it says Jones Stupik, guidance and control engineer. She's talking about something about Europa Clipper. So she's at a telescope. Let's see what it says. Okay, this is dated March 27, 2019. And it's on www.nasa.gov. And it's dated it's by Jones Stupik, guidance and control engineer. When Jones Stupik was a child, her parents bought her a mini planetarium that she could use to project the stars onto her bedroom ceiling. While she didn't always plan to become an engineer, she always liked math and science and credits her high school guidance counselors for steering her in the right direction to become an engineer. Now she's part of the team developing NASA's Europa Clipper mission that will explore Jupiter's moon, Europa, to see whether the icy moon could harbor conditions suitable for life. So there's Miss Jane Stupik, and it doesn't tell what she's doing. but it's all under Women's History Month. So she's standing at a telescope, looking out into the heavens. Good old telescopes, and way to go, Joan Stupik. So she's part of the team. So to me, that is very exciting. Now, I'm on the Europa Clipper page. It's at www.nasa.gov/Europa, and it could tell you all about the Europa Clipper mission. And here's an overview. Europa overview. NASA's Europa mission will conduct detailed reconnaissance of Jupiter's moon Europa and investigate whether the icy moon could harbor conditions suitable for life. The mission will place a spacecraft in orbit around Jupiter in order to perform a detailed investigation of Europa, a world that shows strong evidence for an ocean of liquid water beneath its icy crust and which could host conditions favorable for life. The mission will send a highly capable, radiation-tolerant spacecraft into a long looping orbit around Jupiter to perform repeated close-by flybys of the icy moon. So radiant-tolerant. So people have to be radiant-tolerant, radiation-tolerant when they go into outer space. NASA has selected 9 science instruments. Here we go. The selected payload includes cameras and spectrometers to produce high-resolution images of Europa's surface and determine its composition. An ice-penetrating radar will determine the thickness of the moon's icy shell and search for subsurface lakes similar to those beneath Antarctica's ice sheet. The mission will also carry a magnetometer to measure the strength and direction of the moon's magnetic field. Which will allow scientists to determine the depths and the salinity of its ocean. Gravity measurements will also help confirm the existence of Europa's subsurface ocean. So as I said, they do all kinds of experiments with all kinds of instruments. And one of them, I remember, on one of the moons around Saturn, they could tell how much the water inside was swooshing, which would affect the vibration or the movement of the planet itself. And somehow they can do all these fabulous experiments. So thank you for listening. This has been another edition of AstroTalk. So I'm going to put it back onto Auto DJ, and in 5 seconds, it will go back on Auto DJ, and you can listen to music. So thank you for listening. This was Marco. You have been listening to another